Hello and welcome to the programme. Well, tonight we bring you a special programme which was recorded on the grounds of Áras an Uachtaráin over a 12-month period. President Michael D. Higgins has been interested in the protection of biodiversity for many years now. And in November of 2019, he asked for a specialist team to develop plans to protect the flora and fauna on the grounds of Áras an Uachtaráin and in the Phoenix Park. This had followed publication of the report to the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, which confirmed the acceleration of biodiversity loss in Ireland, sounding alarm bells for potentially catastrophic species loss and deterioration of globally important habitats. It coincided with unanimous cross-party support for a motion passed in Dáil Éireann declaring a climate and biodiversity emergency. The result of the President's request was a year-long biodiversity audit of the grounds of Áras an Uachtaráin. Terry Flanagan followed the course of the research for Mooney Goes Wild.
Áras an Uachtaráin is a very special place. It's an iconic building situated in 130 acres of mixed habitat parkland in Dublin's heartland. Originally a modest 18th century house, today it serves as the official place of residence for Ireland's president. It has been greatly expanded over the years and is both a family home and a venue for formal state occasions. It's a property of enormous historical interest. The list of visiting dignitaries over the years reads like a who's who of major world figures. Pope John Paul II, Nelson Mandela, President Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, John F. Kennedy. In 2011, during President Mary McAleese's term of office, Queen Elizabeth II became the first British monarch to visit the residence in 100 years.
Uachtaráin. Agus a chuidse.
Speaking Irish in Dublin Castle was another first for a royal, but when she planted an oak sapling at the Áras, she followed in the footsteps of her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, who had planted an oak tree here way back in 1853. The President and his wife, Sabina Higgins, take a great interest in the parkland and gardens and have introduced new Irish varieties of organic vegetables. And it's the grounds that are the focus of our story because, due to a number of different factors, a unique landscape has been allowed to evolve. Thousands of different species have been identified here in Ireland, and this diversity is threatened because of how the land is managed and the impact of other human activity. And as things stand, about 20% of species are currently threatened with extinction. Recently, UNESCO highlighted that the appearance of COVID-19 has shown that when we destroy biodiversity, we destroy the system that supports human life. In a pre-virus world, when addressing Ireland's first National Biodiversity Conference in 2019, President Michael D. Higgins highlighted the profound challenges facing us in terms of threats to our natural environment, and emphasised that reversing biodiversity loss would require all of us to be leaders within our own spheres of influence. The President told me that this turned out to be a pivotal moment for him.
I more or less made my mind up at that stage that the best thing to do was to try and give an example. So I made my mind up really that why not use the 130 acres at Áras an Uachtaráin, because it has such diversity in it. It's exceptional to think that there is such a rich source of biodiversity so close to a major city in Europe. And then we had really so much capacity to do interesting things, and we were faced with challenges in it, you see, about how to respect all the balances to be able to retain the rich diversity of species. And it is, after all, the house and gardens of the home of the President of Ireland. And my hope is that both their grounds of Áras an Uachtaráin in town, but also the Phoenix Park, I often think we don't realise what a wonderful facility it is to have this lung in a major European city and for it to have the available to the people of Ireland. The more it is used, the better. I like it. But I have to say that my concern, to be quite frank with you, is wider than the Auras altogether. When you look at the European statistics, the global statistics should frighten anybody. Our very capacity for life on this planet is being very severely damaged. And it's been damaged very much by strategies that were short-term and where people really didn't take responsibility for the consequences of our action. In one's our relationship to the complex forms of life that make up the biodiversity cycles, we all have great responsibilities.
President Michael D. Higgins. Auras Anuchtaron contains many Victorian features, including an arboretum, wilderness areas, pleasure grounds, avenues, walks, ornamental lakes and walled gardens. Some of these date back to the construction of the house in 1751. The grounds are also home to a wide variety of animals, and one of the unique aspects of the Auras is that about 15 years ago, the park's iconic deer were excluded from the estate. Deer present a particular threat to biodiversity because they eat everything around them, and they've had no natural predator in Ireland since the wolf became extinct here. Unless the deer population is controlled, it will have a devastating effect on both flora and fauna. The Office of Public Works manages the Phoenix Park and the Auras. Margaret Gormley is the OPW's Chief Park Superintendent.
The park was originally set up as a royal deer park in 1662, so it was enclosed to keep deer in and the people out, where today it's very, very different. But the landscape that we have today is really inherited from a deer grazing of the grounds of the whole Phoenix Park. And I think what is unique within the Auras itself, because this is an area, you know, within the Phoenix Park, that the deer have no access to the Auras. So the understory here in the park is very, very different to the understory that you would get out in the main Phoenix Park. And we've managed to maintain a secure environment here in the Auras, where we're able to let the leaves fall on the ground, let, you know, all the different habitats grow here in the Phoenix Park and evolve. And it's very different, you know, within the Auras than out in the Phoenix Park. If you go for a stroll in the Phoenix Park, you will see all the trees, they're browsing, you know, are right up to the head height of a deer. Mm-hmm. People mightn't realise that.
Which you don't see here.
No, you can see here the trees, the planting, we can let different areas grow up. But the park is a hugely important area from a biodiversity point of view, and the studies have been done. But I think what is unique with this particular study, it's a year-long study.
So what will you be looking for, or what will you be looking at?
We're looking at everything. All ecosystems within the Auras. Like in the Phoenix Park generally, we have over 25 different types of habitats, 5 different types of grassland. So we're looking at all of that here within the Auras itself. And I think it'll be very interesting because some of the areas within the Auras are very well maintained. You know, you're visiting heads of state, formal parterres that were established in the 1800s. And then you have other areas like the wilderness area, which historically was called a wilderness right through the centuries. So we just don't want to record what here at this particular period of time. We want to look at what good recommendations are we going to get to see how can we improve this from a biodiversity point of view, but yet retain the historical setting here in the Auras. It's a subset of the park, but it's the most comprehensive audit that we'll have ever done. So I think in that sense, it will be very unique. It will look at how all these habitats and ecosystems interact with each other, and then the benefits of that, that we can derive from that, that we will be able to roll out, not alone just in the Phoenix Park, but maybe some of our other sites as well.
To realise the President's ambition for a year-long audit, the OPW duly enlisted the help of experts from Trinity College Dublin. Professor Jane Stout is an internationally renowned expert on the value of biodiversity. She assembled a team of taxonomists, including specialists in plants, fungi, insects, mammals, reptiles and amphibians. The project leader is zoologist Dr. Evan Cochran. She believes that the global loss of biodiversity is such a daunting challenge that even thinking about tackling it can be overwhelming. So the best place to start is at home.
It's really important in terms of fighting biodiversity loss because I think you need to focus on what's in your immediate surroundings. when thinking about tackling a problem like biodiversity loss, sometimes these problems can seem so big so that they seem insurmountable. But actually, if we start to look at the biodiversity that's around us, where we live and where we work and in our local areas, and we start to care about those areas and understand what's there and how to protect it, we can then begin to make some inroads in terms of reversing biodiversity loss. So starting close to home is what's really important.
When the team set out on this adventure, their mission was clear: to capture the full range of biodiversity. A snapshot in time, if you like, of what's thriving and what's not in the grounds of the Auras right now. They would need to quantify both habitat and species diversity to boost existing knowledge and come up with recommendations for supporting sustainable and environmentally friendly management practices into the future. It would entail a large team of scientists visiting and revisiting habitats in the grounds, gathering information from season to season over this 12-month period of exploration, and they kindly invited me to tag along, starting in late November of 2019. Autumn, the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. It's a time when our woodlands and grasslands come alive with lots of different species of mushrooms and toadstools.
Yeah, Terry, look at these.
On a bleak November evening, I met up with mycologist Professor Paul Dowding, who was trawling for mushrooms less than 100 metres from the front door of the Auras.
My God, I've never seen a ring as big as that before.
No, it's big fungi too. It doesn't have an English name. It's a funnel cap, that's the general name for this genus. It's Clytosibi geotropa.
They're very large. They're like the size of, almost the size of a dinner plate, and they're very, very rubbery.
I've never eaten them before finding them in the Auras, and I've had four good meals out of them from the two previous collections.
You weren't worried about eating them, no?
Well, I'd identified it positively.
Yeah. Now, I know you are a professor
yes.
of mycology, so I don't mean that in a bad way.
No.
But most people are very, very wary of
eating.
Well,
they should be.
Yeah.
Yes.
Your role here is to come in and to study the fungi that are here, the different species. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
And what have you found so far?
I found, apart from today's catch, 79 species of fungi.
That, to me, seems quite a lot.
It's quite a lot, but we have to wait until the plant people do their work, because the mycologists, the professionals, reckon you should find six species of fungi for every one species of plant.
Right, give us a little look in the bag. Let's see what you have here.
Here we go. It looks like a mess of mushrooms, which it is, but it's very important if you're collecting mushrooms to collect in something rigid, because if you put them in a poly bag, they all squidge together.
Yeah. There's a beautiful purple one there.
Yeah, two purple ones. Here. Yeah, I'll take it out. There are two purple ones. There's a fat, lumpy one, which
Very,
very vigorous, with a brownish cap, very fat stem. And there's a much more delicate one.
That's very pretty, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a very pretty colour.
Absolutely. Wonderful colour underneath.
Would you expect to find any unusual mushrooms here in the Auras that may not be found in the park itself?
Yes.
And why is that?
Because there are no deer in the Auras, and deer do eat fungi.
Right. And is that good for the fungi or bad?
For some of them it's good, because the fungus spores actually have to pass through the guts of an animal before they can germinate and grow again. But for many fungi it would be bad in that they don't actually need that transformation, as it were, in the warm body of an animal. They would prefer, or they would do better, to disperse their spores in the air.
Right. Now, you've been here three or four times already in this study.
Mm.
What has surprised you most?
Delighted me, actually, the openness of the woodland. Most of the woodlands we're familiar with in Ireland are plantation woodlands, and they're close and they're dark. But here's a woodland that's sort of well-spaced, there's grass growing among the trees, which is a bit of a pain when it comes to looking for small fungi, but even so, it's good. There's a very wide variety of trees. The ground is obviously ungrazed and undisturbed, and most of it is unfertilized. All pluses for fungi.
And the species that you have found so far, are you surprised by any of those? Or is it just the numbers of them?
It's the numbers of them, yes, that I'm surprised by. But then there's all sorts of different habitats. That's the beauty of these old estates. But this one's been, is not like the estates of the 19th century Anglo-Irish that have been allowed to decay or been broken up and they've effectively been ruined. This one has been cared for two centuries.
And that has been to the benefit of the mushrooms.
Absolutely, yes.
And Paul would return on many occasions throughout the year to observe the different species present across the seasons. Whilst nature never sleeps, the winter months were quieter than normal, when the onset of the COVID-19 epidemic meant that few research outings took place. But come the spring, we were full of hope for new beginnings. As humans, we can never rely on creatures from the natural world to dance to our tune, or indeed to turn up on cue when required. Our quest to find frogs and newts proved fruitless. This is a time when newts should be present, and we might not have known it then, but it was concerning that they weren't. There was more disappointment in March when I went looking for bats with Dr. Evan Gochran and her colleague Colly Ennis. There wasn't a single bat in sight. But instead, we found something quite wonderful. A copious cluster of rare spiders.
So we're just walking up to quite a small tunnel. Mm-hmm. Have to certainly duck here. It's probably only 3 foot tall.
It's like something out of Indiana Jones, isn't it?
It certainly is.
It's really exciting. So this is an old ice cellar on the grounds of Oris on Uachtaráin, and it's basically a man-made cave, and this is the type of habitat these spiders really love. They like these concave roofs with dampness.
And there's certainly no human activity anywhere around here.
No.
Even would you reckon there's much activity, say mammal activity here?
Oh, there's absolutely mammal activity here. Right behind where you're standing is a badger latrine, actually.
Right.
And if you look at the very top of the tunnel up here and you see that...
Which is about 10 or 15 metres away.
I'd say so, yeah. And that goes under the footpath that we just came over. That leads us right to a badger set.
Right. So you think the badgers then are definitely using this tunnel?
They are. I know for sure they're using this tunnel because I've seen the evidence myself when I was in here the other day.
What do you think then, Colly?
Well, along here I've already seen a rather emaciated looking lace-web spider, a male.
Is that a common spider?
Common enough, yeah. And one of our native ones as well. But if you look up here, Terry...
Follow the torch.
You see the torch? See,
yeah.
There's a kind of a cotton ball...
I see it.
...hanging from the ceiling.
That's about 3 or 4 metres away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's your egg sac of the cave spider.
And you're sure it's the cave spider?
100%.
Why can't you tell me it's the cave spider?
Because they have a distinctive way of laying their eggs where they'll make the egg sac but suspended from the ceiling.
I see.
And it's quite unique. Given the location, given that, you can put
pretty much 100%.
Now, we are going to collect samples. I have my little spider collection jar here so we can identify it under a microscope using eye patterns, and you also use the reproductive organs to identify spiders, but you can put the house on that they're actually here.
Right.
I'm going to try and grab one.
Come on, I'll follow you up as best I can because...
No, watch your head now.
Yeah.
Please watch your feet as well for the old badger.
I can see it here.
Yeah.
God almighty, it's of course being tall.
Now you can see there's a lot of...
Let me just get in there.
There you go. There's a classic. There's a male.
Oh, yeah, I can see him there.
See him there.
Yeah, black. He's quite a distinct colour, isn't he?
Yeah, it's that brown and black. And you can tell he's a male. And if I just... If you keep your torch on him there for me, if you don't mind assisting.
Yep.
I'll get my torch on as well. And I can tell he's a male because he has those pedipalps.
Now, explain pedipalps.
Pedipalps are the male spider's reproductive organs. He'll deposit his DNA, his sperm, on a web.
Then
he'll use these two things that look like boxing gloves on the front of his head to suck it up, much like a turkey baster.
Right.
And then he will approach a female in her web and signal to her with vibrations and movements. Yeah. I want to get an adult female because they are
Were a little bit further in, Collie, and there were definitely there's an egg sac right above your head, actually, just ahead of us.
Oh yeah, this one on the right.
So this is a different species of spider, and you know I can tell that because this is an orb weaver.
Mm-hmm.
She has that.
So this is a particularly good habitat then.
Well, spiders. If you can if you look at the ceiling there, and put your torch up, you'll see a lot of these little.
There's a lot of mosquitoes
and that's perfect.
Flying insects,
plenty of food for them.
Yeah. Plenty of food. It's quite there's a very big badger latrine right there.
Yeah, see that? Yeah, and there's a very distinctive smell in this. The further into this cave we're going.
This is
Look at that. Yes, you see the poo in that.
You can, and you see the orange marking on the poo. That's actually the secretion from their anal scent gland.
Right.
So they have scent glands, anal scent glands and caudal scent glands, and both of those are important for conveying information about the badgers individually and sexual reproductive status, their social status, that sort of thing.
So it's not just poo.
It's not just poo.
It's an information gathering process.
It's very important. It's like the local newsletter.
Yes.
For what's going on and who's been here and who's around and what's happening with them.
So whereas in humans we sit on the loo and read the newspaper, what the badgers do is they sit here and they poo and they produce the newspaper as well.
That's true, yeah. If you were to be looking at a latrine that was on the border between two different social groups, you'd have the badgers from each social group using it, and they'd be finding out information about one another there as well. It's how they maintain their territory boundaries.
Now, if you come up here,
yeah.
I have a queen
here. Oh, my God.
A queen.
Look at her. There she is.
Just, oh, yeah.
That's now a classic, beautiful female cave spider.
Oh, yeah. Now, she's a good bit bigger, isn't she?
She's much bigger.
What's this coming up behind? Look.
That's massive.
This is an orb weaver species. You can see they have the orb weaver webs. Yes. So they're separate species, but interesting to see what they are as well. These guys, though, are incredible.
Girls,
are those?
There's one there to the right.
Another one here and another one here.
Wow.
And she's well established. And if you look right along here, you have your moths.
Yeah, right above your head.
Yeah, see the moth. Look here. There's more here.
Moths there.
Three-haired moths.
Look at the amount of mosquitoes which are hanging out here as well.
This is a fantastic habitat, isn't it?
Something and here like we have a beautiful classic.
Another one hanging.
Oh, there's
egg sac. It's absolutely beautiful. This is a real thrill for me because I absolutely love these spiders. and it's rare enough. This is my second time for seeing them in the wild. So
isn't this amazing, even? You've come here looking for bats.
Yes.
You've checked out this little cave, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
And guess what? We found loads of spiders.
Absolutely. And ones that are, you know, quite rare as well, really.
And that's the great thing about having such a diverse team from Trinity College, because you could flip a log and find some fungus that obviously I wouldn't recognise, but you
could be out with somebody else.
We'd just call Paul and he'd be able to tell us.
Or if I find a piece of poo, I'll just call. It looks mammalian and I'll call. Even so, it's great to have a great team and we're all learning off each other.
Yeah.
So, Collie, this has been a really good night for you.
Yeah, I'm really pleased.
You weren't expecting this, no?
No.
It's just a real thrill.
I feel like a little kid again at Christmas. It's really good.
Oh, my God.
Look at that male. He's stunning.
He's big.
He's a big guy. Okay. Wow.
And what a fabulous night of discovery that was with Evan and Collie. In Ireland, we have more than 450 bird species. We're blessed with seabirds, garden birds and birds of prey, to name but a few. Species like blackbirds and robins, who are with us year-round, and others like cuckoos and swallows, who are annual visitors. Keeping a close eye on these populations is crucial to conservation. And there's work being carried out all the time to ensure that experts are aware of changes as they occur. One of the ways bird populations are monitored is through regular transects. This involves a slow walk along a predetermined route within an area under study. It allows researchers to spot and identify bird life within a defined area, either visually or by their song.
That's not characteristic for anyone, is it? Can you see them?
By repeating the transect a number of times throughout the year, it's possible to build a picture of the bird species present as well as their numbers.
All we're trying to do here is have a standard transect through a part of this area, and we've arranged the transects to cover all the different habitats within the garden. So we've got three different transects, and each one If we do all three each time, then we get a standardised comparison from one month to the next. And all we're trying to do is give all the different birds for different seasons equal chance of getting detected. So we will do some in the summer, we did some in the winter. And in the winter we were getting many fewer birds, but they would be different birds. They'd be the birds that are staying over here for the winter, and then those birds will travel elsewhere, will travel further north to breed. And we're now getting birds that come to us to breed that overwinter in Spain or further south. So we swap over a different group of birds each time we come.
But is it also not a case that you're getting more birds now than in the wintertime for a different reason, because we're hearing them singing? I was just watching as you were counting them there this morning, and quite a lot of them, probably two-thirds of the birds that you recorded this morning, were from their call or from them singing. You wouldn't have had that a month or 2 months ago.
That's absolutely true. So the ones, the resident birds, are comparing between months isn't a good idea because of that. But if you think about it, all of this is just an estimate. So if you are walking through a habitat and you're trying to count how many robins are there, you will get the robins who happen to be male, who happen to be singing and defending their territory, so happen to be adult and are singing when you happen to pass. So all of those things mean that there's many more robins that you didn't detect. Mm-hmm. Now, robins are unusual in that both the sexes sing, but quite a lot of birds, only the males sing. So you're going to miss all the females, you're going to miss all the juveniles, and anybody who hasn't got a territory. So it isn't a way of counting the total number present. What it is telling you the minimum number that were definitely present.
And particularly as well, the species that are here.
Yes, and the species that are here, absolutely. So you get some idea of abundance, and you get a comparative idea of abundance here compared to a different transect in a different part of the habitat, or compared to a different transect in somebody else's habitat. So, you know, outside in Phoenix Park or somewhere else. So the comparison within a given month is fair, but it isn't a total number that's present in the place.
What was your highlight this morning?
Oh, my highlight would probably be the dabchicks, the little grebes, because there's two beautiful little grebes in lovely breeding colours sitting on the pond. And I was delighted to see two of them there, because it's very likely that they'll breed there.
I'd have to say my highlight this morning was the sparrowhawk chasing across over our heads.
That's
really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And another thing I was amazed at too, were the number of herons. There were quite a large number of herons here.
Well, there's a heron breeding colony.
Quite close there at the zoo.
Nearby. And so, yes, absolutely. We get a lot more herons here than you might expect in the middle of a parkland.
And they have become so tame lately. I mean, go back 20 years ago, you couldn't get near a heron. You couldn't get a photograph of a heron. Now you can walk up by them.
Yeah, and they seem to be very adaptable to humans, because I lived in Holland for a while, and in Holland you virtually trip over them. They are absolutely tame, and in the middle of the cities everywhere because of all the canals everywhere. So, yeah, they do seem to adapt to being with humans quite easily.
So overall, were you happy with this morning's work?
Yeah, delighted. Yeah, and I'm only halfway through. We've got to do the other half in a minute.
Okay. Then it's time for breakfast.
Yes. Second breakfast.
Professor Nicola Marples.
Isn't it just lovely when on warm sunny days we can sit and marvel as butterflies fleetingly flutter by?
Love is like a butterfly, as soft and gentle as a sigh. A multicolored moods of love like its satin wings.
But we tend to ignore the poor old moths, who fly unglamorously under the radar in the dark of night. Maybe it's because they're active when we tend to be asleep. On the other hand, it could be because we think of them as being cloth-eating nuisances. Or is it quite simply that they're just not as pretty as their diurnal relatives, often resulting in them being dismissed as the butterfly's ugly cousin? Well, it's not all about appearances, you know, and we shouldn't ignore them, because they too have an important role to play in the ecosystem. I headed off late one evening in May with Dr. Ferdy Marnell of the National Parks and Wildlife Service. I watched him set up a number of moth traps, then returned the following morning at dawn to see what he and his team had managed to catch.
This one here?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the one I was
Oh, wow, yeah. What a
spot. Very,
so
very
a gorgeous looking there for you. Yeah. Show you now, there's about five of them that look identical.
Okay.
Ah, brilliant.
But I think one of them
Is this one of these ones where we'll have to inspect the genitalia?
So, Ferdia, you've just gone through your three trap boxes. Are you happy?
A bit disappointed, but it's the first session now, so yeah. It was, to get a proper audit here, you'd need to come back at least once every couple of weeks, right through the year, ideally, because there are moths that'll turn up in December that are gone by February, you know, so we've picked up a good baseline, but I'd expect there to be a lot more moths hanging around here. We just need to come back and try again.
When we left last night, the last thing you said was maybe 25 or 30 species. I know you're only just topping them up, but do you think, have you hit the 25 or 30?
I don't think so. No, we've a few that have to be identified. So there's some micro moths, so the small moths, which take a bit of identification. So you need a hand lens. Or what we have been doing is we've been taking photographs and then sort of zooming in on the photographs, but you need a good book. And usually the backup of an expert to be really confident about identifications for the micros.
What is the role of the moth in the ecosystem? We know the butterfly, we know the bee, they're interested in pollination. The moths are nocturnal, they come out at night. Where do they fit into it all?
Yeah, well, they're nocturnal flowers, some of the evening-scented flowers, night-scented flowers that moths are often attracted to. So they do play a role in pollination as well. They're very important food for bats in particular and evening birds like swallows and swifts. They will feed a lot on moths. There's daytime flying moths as well. So they've actually very broad spectrum in terms of the ecosystem. And then obviously the caterpillars are very important in terms of breaking down detritus and vegetation and dead leaves. But they also feed on live plants as well. So they have a very important role in that.
Because in general, people don't think of them very, very highly. I mean, you think of them, they've got a bad press. The moths, the mothballs, they eat your clothes and so on.
Yeah, there's about two species or three species that turn up in people's houses that can be a bit of a pest.
Yeah.
And then there's about 1,000 species that live outside people's houses that never go near people's houses.
So give us a ballpark figure. I know you haven't added them all up yet, but are you talking about 20 different species tonight?
Yeah, if we can identify all the micros, and sometimes that's very hard to do without actually dissecting them, then we probably are up about 20, yeah. But in theory, I mean, in a state like this that's as big as this and that has so much variety of habitat, we should be well over 100 species.
So it's back again later on for more?
Yeah, well, I think we'd have to be back a couple more times. If we want to get a proper breakdown of what's here, we need to trap several times into the autumn.
Dr. Ferdia Marnell. Moths are one of the main food sources of bats. There are 9 different species in Ireland. And thankfully, numbers for all of them are either stable or increasing. A few bat facts. There are over 1,200 species worldwide, and they make up about 20% of the planet's mammals. They're the only mammals who can really fly, and for the avoidance of doubt, they're highly unlikely to ever become entangled in your hair, because their echolocation skills are so finely tuned. And only 3 species suck blood, none of which are found in Ireland. Anyway, if there were moths in the grounds of the Auras, there was a fair chance that bats would be present too. We might have been unlucky earlier in the year, but this time we would not be disappointed. Now, looking out there now, it's not quite dusk yet. It's probably about, 15 minutes or so. It's quite bright. You're looking up. Oh, there's one. There's one there.
Yep,
see it.
We have a bat there, and our detector is telling us that we have a Leiser's bat because it's echolocating at about 25.
There you see, look, I can see him. Look, swirling around just outside the trees.
Absolutely. So this is a bat that you will see quite often just as it's starting to get dark.
Yeah.
So people often mistake them for birds. They think they're swallows.
There he is again, look at him. He's actually quite big. He's very like a swallow.
He is. He's one of our largest bats. He is our largest bat, in fact. And he will forage in open habitats, very much like a swallow does, swooping around above the trees and picking off little insects as he goes.
There's 2 of them. I can see a second one.
Yeah. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear the plip-plop, plip-plop, and that's him echolocating. And every now and then you'll hear it turn into a much more rapid kind of buzz. And that's him honing in on an insect.
Oh, yeah. Now, there's 2 of them I can see there. Why aren't we hearing 2 of them on the record? This one is very, very close now.
Very close.
He's actually coming in right to us.
Now, what we also have, I think...
Now, he's very, very close to us, but we're not hearing them on the detector.
I need to change the frequency because I think we have a pipistrel here as well.
So we've 2 species here.
Two species now.
And that one there is actually a little bit lower. Now, you can hear that. Yeah. That's a different sound altogether,
isn't it?
It's
a different sound. It's faster.
Yeah.
And that one is echolocating at 55 kilohertz roughly. Right. So that is our soprano pipistrelle. And he's foraging a little bit lower down.
Yes, I noticed that.
Than the Leislers.
This is if it's a different niche that they're using.
Well, that's it, because they don't want to be competing for the same resources.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a look at the sonogram here, you can see that one here is...
So we're looking at the iPad here as well. And on the iPad too, we might turn that one down just a little bit.
Sure.
So looking at the iPad here, you have the iPad turned down. But we're watching it here. We're getting a visual effect.
Yes.
And we can see both the bats on it.
That's right.
And is that recording at the same time?
It is recording at the same time. And here you can actually see I'm picking up both species. Down here, 25. I've got the Leislers. And up here, 55. I've got the soprano pip.
I thought I heard something there myself.
Yeah, that might have been the Leislers.
Because I know as you get older, the chances of you hearing these, your hearing disimproves.
That's right, yeah.
It's to do with the frequency.
It is, yeah.
Are you catching? You're a lot younger than me.
I don't know if my hearing is all that good, though. I'm actually not really catching it. Kids are excellent at hearing Leislers bats, though. They can pick it up very easily.
There he is again. Look,
look. Now he's coming quite close.
To within 10 metres of us.
Yeah.
And right down to ground level.
He was swooping at something that was down near the grass.
So what he's doing now is he's actually sending out a high frequency call. Is that right?
That's right. He's basically creating an audio picture of his environment. Now people say, you know, as blind as a bat. That's not true. They're not blind, but their primary sense is of hearing. And they have evolved a really unique way among the mammals of... of navigating their way around the environment and finding their food. So essentially what they do is they send these really high frequency shrieks out into the environment, and it bounces back off the different things in their environment, such as the trees and also the insects. And by detecting the rate that those echoes return, it builds up this picture in their brain. So they essentially see with their ears.
But they also have to see in three dimensions.
That's right, yeah.
Because not only if the echo comes back from the insect is also moving.
Mm-hmm.
And the bat has to take into account this movement as well, if he wants to catch him 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds later.
Yeah. They've evolved really sophisticated adaptations in their nose and their ears, which is often why you'll see that some bats have like very funny shaped ears or strange shaped noses. And they are basically designed to pick up the returning echoes and allow them to figure out where they are in space. So directionality, up, down, left, right, as you say, build a 3D picture.
It's very complex.
It's really complex. And actually, what's even cooler is that a lot of moths have evolved the ability to scramble the bat's calls, so they scramble the echo location returning.
Really,
yeah. Like an arms race, yeah.
My God.
So I think what we might do now is take a wander up through the... forested pathway and see if we can pick up any different species.
Great, so we've two already.
We do.
How many do you hope to get?
Well, it would be lovely if we got 8.
Wow.
Because that's pretty much everything that you find on this in this side of the country. The only bat that you wouldn't get here is the lesser horseshoe bat, which is only found on the west.
Any time I've ever been out, I've never got more than 3.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see.
Good.
I'm optimistic.
Dr. Evan Cochrane, and I must say, the number of bats we came across was surprising, in a good way. We actually managed to locate 6 different species that night alone.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
The beautiful home there of the bumblebee. Many animals are pollinators, including birds, bats and butterflies. But bees are the most important in most ecosystems. 2/3 of the world's crop species depend on animals to transfer pollen between the male and female flower parts. Habitat destruction and the use of specific pesticides are having a devastating effect on their numbers globally, and conservationists are particularly concerned with the loss of bumblebees, with many species listed as critically endangered. But how are they doing in Áras an Uachtaráin? On a lovely evening in late June, I met up with Professor James Stout on the lawn, not far from the front door of the house.
So here we are in this incredible patch of lavender that's literally humming with bees.
Well, as I look around me, I must be able to see 100 different bees, and they're nearly all bumblebees, and they're different varieties. They're not all the same species.
That's right. We've got, I think, 6 or 7 different species of bumblebee here, the commonest species that we see in our gardens. But yeah, all of them here on this patch of lavender, along with some honeybees as well.
Now, the bumblebees, I think there are, 20 or 21 species in the country?
21 species of bumblebee in Ireland. It was 20 until a few years ago when a new species arrived.
Yeah, that was almost 20, I remember.
Yeah, so we're officially 21 now. But there's a handful that, you know, of 6 or 7 that are very common and widespread. We've got those 6 or 7 species here. We've got a species that's fairly widespread in Ireland, but not all that common, which is the moss carder bee. That's the really beautiful blonde ginger-coloured bee that we've seen here.
Now, for people who don't know the difference between them, most people think of honeybees. These are a different bee altogether. They're a bigger bee. They're a kind of a furrier bee.
Yeah,
they're like a little ball, aren't they?
They are. They're wider and fluffier, and they don't have the same kind of social life as honeybees do. So we're familiar with honeybees in their hive and these perennial colonies with thousands of individuals. Bumblebees also create colonies, but they're much smaller and they die out each year. So they're annual colonies as opposed to perennial ones.
And they have that lovely tail. And don't you name them by the colours of the tail? The white-tailed bumblebee and the yellow-tailed
bumblebee.
That's
right, the common names, yeah, because it's difficult to distinguish some of the species. Then we use the colour patterns. But actually, you know, there's a few species that look exactly the same, and so the colour patterns aren't always a reliable distinguisher between all of the species.
I'd have to say, I always thought that they're much prettier than the honeybee.
Ah, yeah, absolutely, I agree. The honeybee, in comparison, is actually quite drab, and there's a lot of people know about the honeybee and its life cycle and the fact it produces honey, but actually when they see it they're quite surprised, because a lot of our kind of kids books, a lot of merchandising and stuff actually has the black and white, the black and yellow striped bee, which is big and round and fluffy, which is more like a bumblebee. So I think that's why people get confused between the two.
Now, this is your second or third or fourth time up here in the Auras. We're into the middle of the summer now.
Yeah.
What have you discovered with the bumblebees?
With the bees? Well, so with the bumblebee, we've seen 6 or 7 species. We've been looking for solitary bees. We haven't seen many solitary bees. We've seen a few mining bees. It's possible that we missed some of the solitary bees because we couldn't sample during the COVID closures. But yeah, we've seen these 6 or 7 species of bumblebees, obviously the honeybees. And we've also been doing surveys of the plants. So we've been tracking the plants, the flowering, what's in flower, what's not in flower, how that changes through the season as well. Because as well as these sort of formal gardens next to the house, there's a lot of ground here. There's 130 acres. And so we're looking at the vegetation and doing surveys of the plants throughout the grounds as well.
Would you expect to find different species or greater numbers of particular species here in the Auras as distinct from the park in general?
In areas like this where we've got lots and lots of flowers, so here there's a huge, huge density of flowers, and that offers a really attractive foraging resource, so that kind of draws them in. Whereas in the more natural areas, you might not see the same sort of density of flowers. So it might be that they're drawn in from other parts of the park into these formal gardens just because, you know, there's so many flowers for them, so much food.
So for those bumblebees that have nested here on the Auras, there's an abundance of food. Is there a possibility then that they don't even leave the Auras?
It's the million-dollar question. Where do bees go and how do they forage? But I think the thing that this shows us is that by providing flowers in our gardens, we can provide a resource that might not be there in the wider countryside. So we can provide food for bumblebees, for other bees, for other flower-visiting insects. When you've got a garden this big, there's plenty of space to provide resources for nesting as well. But even in our own back gardens, there's probably little holes, little crevices where bumblebees nest, because bumblebees nest in holes under the ground, and so you might see in your garden bees coming and going from underneath a paving stone or in the corner of the garden. And because it's an annual colony, they'll come and go, they'll finish their colony and then they'll be gone. So I think if anyone does find a bumblebee nest in their garden, please just leave it alone. It will have a natural lifetime and then it'll disappear at the end of the season anyway.
So what have you learned from the study here in the Auras as regarding the bumblebees, as distinct from bumblebees that would be outside in people's gardens or in the rest of the country?
We've got the same sorts of species. We're here in the middle of a city. We've got the species we'd expect, which is great. We're seeing the common species. They're doing well. There's plenty for them to feed on. So
sorry for cutting across you, but there's a very, very unusual bee there. What's that? I'm not familiar with that.
The one we can see now has extra yellow fur on its face.
Yeah.
And what that's a male. So mostly we see the female, the worker bees, but later in the season the males will start to come out, and you can tell the male of this particular species because his face has this beautiful yellow fur on it, and that makes him quite distinctive from the female that doesn't have any yellow on it at all. And if you're brave enough, if you can tell the difference between a male and a female bumblebee, you can pick up the males because the males don't have a sting. It's only female bees that have a sting.
But they're very docile. Surely the bumblebees are a docile animal.
You have to really annoy a bumblebee for it to sting you, yeah.
And it's that sound again as we listen to them there. It's really beautiful. It's very peaceful.
It is. It's the sound of summer. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Professor Jane Stout. Another great source of information gathering is bird ringing. This is an essential tool for monitoring when and where birds move and how long they live. A uniquely numbered metal ring, which is placed around a bird's leg, provides a reliable and harmless method of identifying birds as individuals. In the autumn, towards the end of the ORIS year-long biodiversity audit, I met up with Professor Nicola Marples and her PhD student, Fionn O'Markig, who are out catching and ringing birds on the estate. Once the young leave the nest, birds often stay in family groups for a short while. So this is a great time to catch large numbers for ringing.
Here we have our first bird this morning, and it's a great tit. And so Fionn, who's a trainee ringer, is taking it out. What you start off by doing is work out which side of the net the bird's gone in from. So he's worked out that it came in from the far side of the net, so he's now taking it out from that side so that it goes out the way it came in.
It's a very delicate operation, isn't it?
It's a very delicate operation, and it's also something that you need to learn to do very gradually and carefully and under supervision. It's surprising to me that they're not more stressed by it, but they really aren't.
D6.
It's just like taking a jumper off a baby.
3, 8, 2, 1, 9.
Excellent. So Fionn, this is our great tit. Is this the first great tit you've ever ringed?
Oh no, these are quite a common one really.
So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to put the ring on.
That's right, yeah. And you do that first because if the bird gets away at any other point in the process, you've done kind of the most important thing. And if this bird is ever caught or found after it's died or anything, it'll have the ring on it saying.
Now the ring is absolutely tiny.
That's right, it's kind
of... And the leg, it's not much thicker than a needle.
That's right, yeah, so it's actually slightly delicate when you're moving it around and stuff. And then we've got these pliers with the differently sized holes, which are for attaching the ring on, and that's it there on the leg now.
Yeah. Now, next, what comes?
Next is aging and sexing the bird. So with great tits, it's to do with the amount of black between
their... Down the belly, so to speak.
Exactly, yes, whether it reaches all the way between their legs. So this one would be a female, then... Aging the bird is based largely on how it's been molting. So I've opened the wing just gently here. We're looking for kind of a contrast between these covert feathers, mm-hmm. which are the higher ones on the wing.
They're so delicate, aren't they? The wings, like the feathers, you can actually see through them.
They are beautiful and quite delicate, so there's particular ways of handling them.
As you're working on the bird, I can see he's looking at you all the time. It's just engrossed in you.
I'm sorry, just picking up the wing ruler, which has this stopper at one end, so that goes kind of next to the shoulder of the wing. It's funny, it's hard to imagine being picked up like this and just being calm, but that's how they normally are. So, 73 wing.
Now, we're in the ORIS here, which is enclosed, and there's a lot of woodland here. It's very well protected for the birds.
Yes, it is. But to be fair, they're flying over the wall. They're living in Phoenix Park. So,
but that's the question. Are they living in the Phoenix Park or are they just living in the ORIS?
They are almost certainly going out into Phoenix Park to forage and moving around. But certainly in the winter, they'll move several miles, several kilometres in all directions because they move around as a flock looking for food. In the summer and in the spring, they, of course, hold territories, so they'll live on their own territory. But at this time of year, they're just beginning to flock up and to move around. So that's a good time to catch them because we're not disturbing their breeding at all. We're just getting them before they disperse.
Professor Nicola Marples and Fionn O'Markig, two of the Trinity team of scientists who spent 2020 exploring the estate of Oris Anuchtaron. The results of the year-long audit confirmed that the grounds support a mosaic of 14 distinct habitats. And within those habitat types, researchers found that 80% are natural habitats like woodlands, grasslands and parklands, and they in turn support more than 800 different species. So there's evidence of about 300 species of plants, nearly 200 species of fungi, around 150 species of invertebrates, and 51 bird and 18 mammal species. A unique picture of the incredible biodiversity hotspot that is Oris-a-Nuptron. So there's much to be celebrated, but it wasn't all good news. Trinity project leader Dr. Evan Gochran shared some more of the results.
While most of our findings in relation to biodiversity in Oris-a-Nuptron were really positive, there were a couple of surprising findings and one or two things that definitely need a little bit of work. Some of the things that would have been nice to find, but in fact we didn't actually find, were any amphibians, for example. There were no frogs and no newts at all within the Oris. And this is surprising because actually you find them outside in the wider Phoenix Park and we're not entirely sure why they're not there. And we also didn't find any hedgehogs, which was really surprising. And also some of the grasslands there weren't really in the best condition that they could be. So there's potential for wonderful species-rich meadows in there. And there are some patches that are great, but there's some other patches that need a lot of work in the future. So with the information that we have gathered over the course of the year, the OPW and the staff of Oris-a-Nuptron are going to be able to get together and implement a management strategy where they'll carry out various initiatives and then continue the really good practices that are already in place in terms of managing the area for biodiversity, planting for pollinators, making sure that the grazing regime that's put in place and the mowing regime that are put in place are all suited to maximising the biodiversity on site. And of course, there will be ongoing research and monitoring of the biodiversity in Oris-a-Nuptron over the coming years as well.
The report provides confirmation, if it were needed, that the grounds of Oris-a-Nuptron are teeming with life. From the charismatic black and white badgers that have taken up residence in an old tunnel by the ice house, to the cave spiders that share this dark and seemingly inhospitable site, from the night flying moths to the day flying bumblebees, the biodiversity in the location is abundant. This audit is an important piece of work by any standards. And full details of the report can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. My thanks to the staff at the Oris for facilitating my recordings and to Professor Jane Stout and her team of scientists from Trinity College Dublin for sharing their investigations and adventures with me throughout the year. There were some wonderful moments that I was thrilled to witness and to capture from Mooney Goes Wild here on RTE Radio 1. The example the project has set in the fight against biodiversity loss is significant both locally and globally. But what the report will ultimately be judged on is the practical response to the survey and the implementation of its recommendations, building on the positives and tackling the negatives. On that note, we'll leave the last word to the man who set this roller coaster research project rolling, Uachtaráin na hÉireann, President Michael D. Higgins.
I suppose if there was one theme that has been running through all of my speeches for the last year or two, it has been of the importance of re-establishing a connection between ecology, economy and society. I'm now convinced absolutely that all over the world this is the best of the debate that is taking place, be it from Pope Francis' encyclicals to really other people who are publishing. We can't really continue a path of destruction, losing species that will in fact are in turn connected to so many other sources of life. So it is never a report, I assure you, to be just put in a drawer or on a shelf. It's a report that is a plan for action. And now what we have in the final section of the report are a set of actions that we propose to take.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Terry Flanagan and produced by Anna Leddy.